This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today is our Doctor in the House segment, and we are talking about World Patient Safety Day, and it fell on the 17th of September, that was yesterday. And this year's theme focuses on health worker safety as a priority for patient safety. So as we all know, the COVID-19 pandemic has unveiled the huge challenges and risks that health workers are facing globally, including healthcare-associated infections, violence, stigma, as well as psychological and emotional issues, illness, and of course, even death. So working in stressful environments makes health workers more prone to errors, which can lead to patient harm. So these are sort of the issues that we want to talk about a little bit today, together with Dr. George Lee, of course, consulting urologist for our Doctor In-House show, as well as Prof. Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine and Professor of Medicine and Infectious Diseases, University of Malaya. And we'd like to discuss how safe health workers equals safe patients, as well as what health systems need to do to prioritize health workers' safety. How are the both of you today?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, looking forward to a good discussion today, because obviously Adiba holds two hats. On one hat, to kind of like advise the new generation of doctors what to expect. On the other hat, and then she is also a healthcare provider and then needs to consider, you know, what sort of health implication and also what sort of implication it will have for herself.
And I'm an infectious disease physician, first of all.
Absolutely.
She's got her eye on what's happening in terms of COVID-19 in Malaysia. And unfortunately, you know, not to start the show on a bit of a negative note, but I'm just curious to know how many health workers worldwide have been affected by COVID-19, if you're talking about being infected as well as deaths due to COVID-19.
Yeah, very, very important question and issue. And it's very hard to know what the absolute number is, especially from the point of view of number of people who've been infected. But there was a recent publication from UK, from Oxford, that have tried to do a scoping of how extensive is the infection. And I believe as of May, June, more than 150,000 infections, 152,888 infections to be exact, amongst healthcare workers, and 1,413 deaths. This is as of May. So it is very troubling and really unnecessary and could be avoided.
What's it looking like here in Malaysia?
Fortunately, in Malaysia, we've done well. And I think we've had slightly over 300 or maybe slightly more now healthcare workers who've been infected. But the majority of those infections, I believe, have been people who were infected in the community rather than in the hospital at work. Those thousands of people who've been infected are also, I'm not saying that they were all picked up in the hospital. It's a combination of at work and in the community.
Putting aside the community infections, if we're talking about hospital-acquired COVID-19 infections, what are the kinds of issues that would have led to them becoming infected?
I think first and foremost is the inadequate protection, especially using the right PPEs, the personal protective equipment. It is super, super important because of the virus being highly transmissible, that healthcare workers put on the right protection for the right procedures. So at one point in many parts of the world, there were not enough PPEs, even in developed countries. You know, colleagues in some countries were telling me that they, when we're talking about developed countries, was scrambling for PPEs and was sent, you know, to the wards without adequate or the right masks, for instance. For example, wearing only surgical masks for procedures that are clearly aerosol generating, where we would advise the N95 mask and shields and, you know, the whole kit caboodle. So I think that's the first and foremost main risk of transmission. And secondly, I think in many places where the hospitals were just overwhelmed with too many patients, that procedures that would ensure, you know, that you minimize the risk of transmission just gets not forgotten, but just didn't get adhered to. So I think we were in Malaysia, we were extremely lucky in that we had adequate PPEs for the most part. For the most part, there were times when it got pretty, pretty hairy. But in essence, we didn't see the levels of infections that put our hospitals at risk.
Aside from COVID-19, though, the issue of hospital-acquired or healthcare-acquired infections, they are a perennial concern among healthcare workers. So what other healthcare-associated infections do we need to be concerned about when it comes to their exposure?
Well, prior to COVID-19, the biggest one is, of course, TB. Mm. And in a sense, the mode of transmission is similar, which is, aerosol with TB. It was aerosol with COVID. It's still debatable whether it's droplet aerosol. So, we've got exactly the same level of transmission, the same modes of transmission. So, wearing the N95 mask in patients with respiratory disease suspected of TB should be universal.
Yeah. Do we have any data of prior to COVID, how many healthcare providers were, contracted with TB? And what sort of protection were people using?
Yeah, I have them at my hospital, but nationally we don't. I mean, I don't have access to it. I'm sure there is. And again, it's difficult to separate whether it is acquired in the hospital or it was acquired in the community. Many years ago, more than 10 years ago, George, I did a small study here at PPUM to look at TB skin reaction, the Mantoux test.
Yes.
And so at that time, this was in the early 2000s, 50% of our healthcare workers had a positive Mantoux. But that's not
50%.
But that's not totally surprising given that, we had BCG vaccination and so forth and so forth. But that aside, when we compared nurses and healthcare workers who work in the medical wards, which have high prevalence of TB, more patients with active TB than the surgical wards, the nurses and doctors in the medical wards had the percentage of people with positive Mantoux was higher than in the surgical ward, implying that, the risk is higher in the medical wards.
Mm-hmm. Of course, if the doctors contracted and not knowing that they have contracted it, the chance of passing to more vulnerable individuals as a patient is also quite high, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have data like that, that, the doctors obviously is the super spreader in that case?
With COVID or active TB?
Active TB.
No, we don't. We don't.
Yeah, okay.
Generally, do we collect data, about, say, hospital-acquired infections and how it's linked to patient infections?
For COVID-19 and for TB, yes, we have that data. Yeah. So one of the things we did for COVID-19 at PPUM was had this extensive healthcare worker surveillance, which we put in place. So any doctor, all the doctors who were working in the COVID ward and nurses and those who came into contact with COVID-19 patients were monitored very extensively. We had at one point, I think nearly 2,000 over 1,500 or something healthcare workers who were under active surveillance to make sure that they didn't become infected with COVID-19. And proud to say that we had very, very few people who were infected of those who became infected, it was less than 10. All were well, but it was in the very early part of the outbreak where, you know, there was low index of suspicion of patients with COVID, and things were a little bit more confused. But once we put all the measures in place, we didn't see any hospital transmission.
Shall we, apart from COVID and TB, obviously the other thing that surgeons and also healthcare worker works with needles are most fearful of is HIV transmission.
Yeah.
Can you clarify what is the chance of getting HIV from an infected patient through needle sticks injury? And then also, what sort of data do we have in Malaysia of healthcare worker getting infected?
So the chance of someone who's HIV positive and is, say, not on treatment, and you get a needle stick injury from that person, if you don't do anything, the risk of transmission after 40 years of the HIV epidemic is still about 0.03%. But if a person living with HIV is on treatment and has an undetectable level, viral load level, the chance of them transmitting the virus through a needle stick injury is zero.
Because undetectable means non-transmissible.
Untransmissible, and that's why on the flip side, doctors who are HIV positive should be allowed to work, provided they're on treatment and are, you know, being monitored. The risk of them transmitting to patients is nil. And in fact, you know, the reported number after all these years of healthcare worker transmission to patients is also very, very uncommon.
Obviously, is that common practice for HIV positive doctors to be on treatment and continue to work? And is that kind of like a normal practice in developed nations?
Yeah. Yes, it is. And, you know, we've made some revision to the MMC guidelines, which are awaiting approval, that, you know, HIV positive doctors should be allowed to work, but they must be under treatment. They must be, you know, supervised and all of that, especially if they're working in areas that we call non-exposure prone procedures. So there are a few exceptions. For instance, someone who's doing gynecological ONG type work, cardiothoracic surgery. But for the most part, you know, if they're on treatment and they're properly supervised, there's no reason why they can't continue to work. The same goes with nurses, not just doctors.
Yeah, well, obviously the other current advancement in HIV transmission is that despite mentioning 0.03% of transmission after needle sticks injury, there's also that precaution of giving doctors or the healthcare providers the antiviral.
Correct.
Could you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this has been in practice for many, many years, that if you... you know, prick yourself with a needle that has been used in someone who's HIV positive, that you are given, and as much as possible, try and do it as early as possible, within 72 hours, be given antiretroviral drugs. And this has, you know, been standard practice all over the world, really.
We'll go for a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to know what's at the root of these healthcare-associated infections. And also, when it comes to health worker safety, are we looking at mental health as well? So I have with me consultant urologist Dr. George Lee, and we're speaking to Dato' Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya, and we're discussing World Patient Safety Day. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Shao-Ik. Today's show is centered around World Patient Safety Day, which was observed yesterday, 17th of September. And the theme this year is Health Worker Safety, a Priority for Patient Safety. Joining me to discuss this are consultant urologist Dr. George Lee and Dato' Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya. Earlier, we looked at some of the major healthcare-associated infections that health workers are exposed to, and no big surprise, COVID-19 tops the list right now, but TB and HIV are the other infections of concern when it comes to the healthcare setting. Prof Adiba, when it comes to, you know, things like needle stick incidents, active TB infection and COVID-19 transmission, when these happen among healthcare workers, it increases the risk of transmission to the patients that they're seeing. Are we talking about human error, or are there systemic problems that are leading to these incidents?
I think it's a bit of both, you know. I get very frustrated and very annoyed when I see junior doctors taking blood, still using needles and syringe and recapping their needles, because that's one of the most common causes for needle stick injuries. You know, there are now devices that are very safe where you take the blood and you just throw the needle straight away without having to recap it. And you know, I tell my medical students and junior doctors, look, I trained in the days before there were all these fancy devices. And, you know, why can't you use these devices that have been designed to keep you safe, you know? So it's human behavior is number one. But yes, there are systems issues. For instance, ideally, people with active TB should be in negative pressure rooms, you know, with double doors and staff who are wearing the right mask, N95 and all that. You can only enter with the right PPEs, with the right N95 masks and not just surgical masks. But how many hospitals in this country actually have those negative pressure rooms? So yes, that's a systems problem.
I mean, the thing is though, you know, you have the equipment that can reduce errors. And if, like you say, junior doctors are still making those mistakes, you know, what can we do then to close that gap?
Well, I think one way is by removing all those needles and syringes and, you know, make them only use those vacutainers and, you know, blood-taking devices that are designed to be as safe as possible and not giving them the option of using needles and syringes.
And now, if we can touch a little bit about something else that, you know, also affects healthcare workers, you know, when you're talking about even healthcare workers who have HIV can continue to work. The same kind of question comes up when you look at healthcare workers with mental health issues and, you know, whether they pose, risks when they're in their workplace. Can we talk a little bit about mental health issues in terms of healthcare worker safety? I'm sure COVID-19 has sort of really made that even more.
Absolutely. The whole uncertainty, especially in the early stages of the COVID pandemic, the whole uncertainty of the mode of transmission. Can we pass it on to when we go home to our elderly parents, to our children? That, you know, that created a lot of anxiety and tension, and we had to have a whole team at the hospital just to provide support for our healthcare workers in terms of mental health support. And my colleagues in the Department of Psych Medicine have done some really nice work looking at this. But in terms of, one is to support them. So it's through education, through, you know, peer counselling and all of that, and the other is if they do develop mental health issues, then again treatment and support outside of COVID. People who do come into trouble, either, you know, already have issues like serious mental health, and let's say bipolar or anything like that, I'd like to reassure the public that there is a system in place that, you know, if we as fellow healthcare workers feel that someone is not fit for practice, then, you know, obviously at the hospital level, you make this assessment. And then there is a division at the Malaysian Medical Council that actually assess people. This is called the Fitness for Practice Committee within the Malaysian Medical Council that we all can refer doctors to, and then there'll be an assessment there whether they, you know, need to come off for a while or whatever.
Is there a system in place to identify when healthcare workers are going through mental health crises or burnouts, you know, so that, you know, it's sort of catching it before it gets.
Yeah. I think this is one area where we can do much, much more work and much better, especially at the junior level. You know, now we're hearing of all kinds of burnout and people dropping out of medicine and clinical practice. Because, you know, compared to my days when I was a junior doctor, it is a lot harder these days. You know, there are more diseases. Public expectation is so much higher. There's a lot more stress and pressure put into
our... You said we had it easy?
We didn't have it easy, but, you know, George, I mean, I think on the one hand, we used to work a lot longer hours.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. Maybe, I don't know why we were more resilient. Why do you think so, George? We were made of toughest... I hate to be like, when I was a younger...
Yeah, that's right.
But I think it is a much more stressful environment these days. And I think, I don't know. And maybe those who've chosen to go into medicine, some may not be so inclined and will put up with less. It's hard to know.
What do you think, George?
I agree that the hours were longer because they were not regulated. I also think that during those times, the supports were not there. I mean, you're just basically told to tough it out.
Do it.
That's right. And then the other issue is that the hierarchy system means the reporting of a bully or accepting somebody is basically having trouble. It's really almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. I think despite those changes, I agree with Adiba, somehow the pressure is somewhat different. So despite that there are a lot better hierarchy and reporting system, that despite regulations on working hours, despite all these mechanisms to identify non-performers, somehow there's still the younger generations of doctors are facing huge amount of pressure. I also concur with the idea that perhaps the expectation is slightly higher because of the scope of knowledge. It's phenomenally bigger than before. In the past, the things that we, you know, it's within 20 years, the amount of knowledge that you need to acquire in order to perform, it's phenomenally huge. So I think that plays a major part.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. And also, I think, you know, we had much smaller teams. That was my experience in Australia, that, you know, although it was hierarchical, but the teams were much smaller and I felt that there was much more support. Whereas now, because there's more doctors, the support from the senior doctors is that one-to-one support or one-to-three, is much less. So I think that also plays a role.
And how much of it is also linked with the terms of employment for young doctors these days, right? You keep hearing about, I mean, now house officers do the shift system.
That shouldn't, you know, the shift system shouldn't really lead to issues, I would have thought.
Okay. And what about then the issue of doctors and health workers on contracts? How much of that sort of, you know, not knowing where you're going to head to next?
Yeah, I think that uncertainty is really, really problematic. I think the Ministry of Health and others are trying very hard to solve this issue, but we can only solve this in a holistic manner. I think that the contract per se is not wrong. I mean, again, George, you and I had to also fight for our contract when you were in the UK and I in Australia. We were not guaranteed jobs. Each year you had to perform and make sure that you're good enough to be hired for the next year and the next year as you're training. But because we have here been used to be guaranteed a job, that and the uncertainty is what's troubling. And you know, we don't know for sure whether the contract, or the junior doctors don't know for sure whether it's going to be 2 years contract or 5 years contract or whatever. So I think the more clarity there is regarding this, the hopefully that comes sooner rather than later, the better. You know, I came through a system that was contract-based,
yeah. But I guess a lot of the gripes are also about the transparency of the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt medicine is a very competitive profession. And then in order to get where you want to be, there's a lot of popularity in terms of getting certain jobs that has certain attraction. And then also...
you want to be in KL, you want to be at certain hospitals. Yeah.
There are only a limited number of that. Mm. And in order to do that, you really need to brush out your CV. And I guess that's the same with any other type one, kind of like a, you know, high-flying jobs. It's just the stress is there, the uncertainty is there. However, the additional part of this is that if you are under so much stress in a banking job, perhaps you just take some time off and nobody gets hurt. However, in a medical profession, if you are continually working under that amount of stress, and then they may mean problems, complications of other people suffering.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, because we are talking about, we're talking about these issues in conjunction with World Patient Safety Day. So, you know, what's that link between all the issues we've been talking about related to doctors and healthcare workers? What's the link with patient safety and patient care?
Yeah, of course, you want your doctors who are looking after you to be in the best of health and in the right frame of mind, right? So, you know, it's hard to care for someone else if you yourself are not in the best frame of mind or in the soundest health. So self-care is also something that we, you know, we are promoting for our own healthcare workers, making sure that, you know, enough sleep, enough everything. But it's easier said than done, I must admit.
Mm-hmm. Is there something that, you know, are there experiences that UMMC can share, you know, in terms of like what you mentioned, you know, self-care? Obviously, it's one thing to encourage it among your staff. It's another to actually, you know, systematize it.
Mm. So we've been talking about things like, of course, we provide, you know, counselling and things like that. But the other is, you know, having wellness programs and mindfulness are some of the techniques that we can have for our doctors and nurses.
Again, do we do enough in terms of collecting data about adverse patient events and how, you know, what are the root causes of those and how they're linked to practices among healthcare workers?
We could do better in those, I guess, in terms of patient error, you know, in terms of prescribing errors and things like that. Yes, you know, hospitals collect data in terms of and look at the root cause. As you said, sometimes it's a system error. Sometimes it's human errors. So, yeah, hospitals do collect data whenever there's an incident report and patient error. I'm sure that happens at your place too, George.
Yes. I think compared to the old days, the there's less taboo to discuss mortality and morbidity. And so I think the culture has also changed. The finger-pointing, the blame culture has also shifted. Because the vast majority of mistakes that when it's analyzed is actually a cascade of a multitude of problems from the whole system. Although it may originate from one person making mistake, however, it always seems to be associated with, for example, X-ray not available, then, you know, the porters were late and then notes were not available and all these cascades and all these no blame cultures, it's so crucial so that nobody will feel incriminated, and eventually we all learn from the mistakes.
Yeah, it cannot be a witch hunt. You know, these morbidity and mortality meetings must not degenerate into a witch hunt, because then it will be very counterproductive. People will not come forward to report, etc.
But at the same time, if we're talking about empowering patients to speak up about, you know, their safety in the healthcare setting, right? And, you know, we're living in an increasingly litigious kind of environment as well. So what would you like patients and consumers to know with regard to how we can play a role as well in terms of improving health workers' practices?
Yeah, I think feedback is always very, very important, positive and negative feedback. But as George said, it shouldn't turn into a, finger pointing and blaming. It's always, the care has to be, it sounds cliche, but, shared care and teamwork.
I think there's a lot to learn because UK underwent their fair shares of all these high-profile scandals, and then the GMC had subsequently evolved and changed into, number one, empowering the patient, number two, also making sure that the doctors are reflecting on their own skills and also their own well-being, and also the teamwork in order to help each other to do like a 360 assessment. Mm-hmm. So to put things into perspective, I think like nowadays for GMC, for you to renew your license on a yearly basis, apart from just demonstrating that you have good track record of your surgical skills, your logbooks, and so on, you also need to have a reflections from your colleagues about how you perform, and including your peers from the same professions, the nurses, the cleaners, and how people look at you. And then on top of that, collections of all the audit of what you're doing, and then in order to identify the areas that you can improve on. And lastly, the patient's compliment. So, the airline industry is always being
a step ahead.
That's right, in order to assess that. And then I think that sort of like patient feedback, it's almost as good as the kind of customers or passengers' feedback, because all these collections of the data will eventually have one goal, which is, profound patient safety at the end of the day.
Mm. But, taking a few steps back, that's why it's so, so important that we train our medical students to the best of our ability and ensure that, our curriculum, our training standards, assessments, all that are on par with the best of the world. And likewise with the specialist training programs. So one of the big projects that I'm involved in at the moment is to kind of improve on the specialist, apart from the undergraduate stuff, the specialist training program, to make it competency-based. So like what George was saying, there's assessments, throughout their training, and it's not just based on exams. So, ensuring patient safety starts with training the best medical students and the best specialists.
Yeah, Adiba, having said all that, we just highlighted something that's quite important, is that the amount of work that we do, a lot of it evolves around clinical work. But all those assessment, audit, reflections, and then all takes time and bureaucracy. And
yep.
The thing that I realized is that we miraculously expect that to happen without
yep.
time off for
yep.
That safety, those data collections. And I think that's something that we're not doing so well. And even in developed nations, which I get feedback from my colleagues in the UK, is that we expect all that bureaucracy to miraculously take place, but
yep.
you serve your hours as well.
Correct. And with very little support, I'm struggling to get you know, a system in place for this kind of continuous work-based assessment, I think the answer is in technology. But all that costs money, right, to develop, to continue and to maintain. So like you said, it we all expect these things to happen miraculously, but it takes time, money and effort. If we want the best doctors in the country, I'm afraid we have to invest in it.
That's exactly what I wanted to bring up as well, because you said it starts with training, but, you know, going a step back even, it starts with investing. And you have to invest in putting in place these frameworks for the training and for the technology and for the monitoring and evaluation to take place.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. It all costs money.
So just looking ahead, you know, what do you think we can learn from COVID-19 in particular? Because I think this pandemic really showed us how important health workers' roles are. And if they're compromised, we are compromised. So what do you think we can learn from COVID-19 moving ahead?
Oh, so many things. I think to start off with that, you know, providing the support and the right equipment, having all the right structure in place is important. Working collaboratively, everybody is important. It's not just the doctors and nurses. Every you know, it's an ecosystem that's so important. And we can, I think, work smarter. The use of technology, telemedicine, has come to the fore so that we reduce the overcrowding in hospitals and unnecessary hospital visits. That needs to be accelerated, the telemedicine for patients. You know, those are just some of the things that come to mind. But we do need to rethink how we deliver healthcare moving forward in the future, not least of which is because, you know, the economy, the global economy has been affected by this whole pandemic. So we need to, you know, in terms of cost effectiveness and all of that, are we doing too many testings, unnecessary testings? Are we prescribing drugs unnecessarily? So I think now is the time to reflect on all of that and really provide healthcare that's evidence-based, that's cost-effective, that's value-based, that leads to the best patient outcome.
And do something about healthcare financing reform, right? We've been talking about that for too long, just talking.
Yes.
What do you think, George?
Well, I you know, in end of March or something, you know, everyone was sending out all the WhatsApp videos. And then there's one thing that strikes me completely. One doctor, research doctor, was asked by a reporter and said, "When do you think we're going to get cured for COVID-19? And she said, "If you pay Cristiano Ronaldo $35 million for football, why don't you ask him for cure?"
She's got a point.
That's right. Yeah. And I think with the last 6 months, undoubtedly, the general public has appreciated the frontliners and healthcare workers. And in adding to that, you know, earlier on in the beginning of the show, Adiba highlighted how many healthcare workers were infected and died in the front line because of that. And I think that just basically opened up the importance and riskiness of the healthcare workers' job. And I really think that attitude will change, and the reform of investing more into healthcare undoubtedly will occur. And the second thing, which I think is the, you know, in every sector of the industry, this is an opportunity that takes a huge quantum leap in the utilization of technology. I also think this will happen in medicine as well, with all these non-contact practices, and then all these utilization of technology. What we're doing now is is something that you wouldn't even imagine 6 months ago, prior to COVID-19, that, you know, we're having a show on Zoom. And I really think the telemedicine, how medicine can be dispensed, notes keeping, and how to integrate all that data, I really think that this is just going to transform overnight because of COVID-19. So some of the good things may emerge from this.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Datuk Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya, about World Patient Safety Day, and the theme was Health Worker Safety, a Priority for Patient Safety. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.